عمده عمل انسان بعد از ایمان.
Self purification is the most significant factor.
امامت یک اصل زنده است در تاریخ اسلام.
Emamat is a living principle in the history of Islam and Shiism.
This is Ulama Speech, the best selection of the speeches of prominent Shia scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Ulama's Speech. In this episode, we invite you to listen to the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. Please stay tuned.
یوم دین هنچه دین معانی مختلفه داره هر کسی هر رای داره دینشه ولذا خدا به کافرها میگه لکم دینکم.
What does یوم دین mean? Deen has various meanings. Everyone has a path which is their deen or way. Thus, God says to the disbelievers, لَكُمْ دِينَكُمْ. To you, it's your way and religion, meaning your path is your own. So deen is the path of each individual. We essentially have no person without a deen or way. After all, what food you eat, what clothes you wear, who you befriend, what you say, how you think, everyone has their path. But we have the true path or din al-haq and the false path or din al-batil. Meaning everyone is on a road, but is it the straight road or a deviant one? Lakum dinukum is said to the disbelievers. It means your way.
خود قرآن یوم الدین معنا کرده میگه یسالونه که ایان یوم الدین.
However, the whole Quran itself explains یوم الدین. In Surah Dhariyat, Ayah 12, it says, They ask you, when is the day of judgment? Then it says, then what will make you realize what the day of judgment is? The day of judgment is a day when no one will be of any avail to another. And on that day, all command is entirely Allah's. So God is the master of the day of judgment. And in your prayer, Salat, we must remember the hereafter. Thank you very much, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening through the program Ulama's Speech, which was the English translation of a short Farsi speech by Hujjatul Islam Qaraati. To find out more about this program and our other programs, please log on to our website, iranradio.ir. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
SOB International Media Festival. The third SOB International Media Festival took place in Tehran from May 3rd to 8th, 2025, featuring prominent international media figures. A specialized session titled West Asia After the Al-Aqsa Storm was held at the IRIB Conference Center as part of the third SOB International Media Festival. The panel featured journalist, documentarian and political analyst Radwan Murtadha, political activist and broadcaster David Miller, and writer and journalist Louis Alday.
With that, we're going to go ahead and get started with today's topic again, West Asia after the Al-Aqsa flood. Mr. Radwan, we want to talk a bit about the status, the shift in West Asia after Al-Aqsa. Now, I want to quote your words. You said that during my relentless pursuit of the truth, I discovered that it has many faces, and each one of us will only believe his own definition of what truth is. These are your words.
Yes.
What do you believe? What is the truth of what is happening now in West Asia after the Al-Aqsa flood?
I want to start from the, from where he
from
finished.
From Mr. Louis or Mr. David?
From Louis.
Yes.
When you ask him, we have to write the history in a correct way.
Yes.
In fact, that we are playing on the ground, on the social media, they are managing internet, they are managing everything. The war on us. Even if you write the name of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, even if you show his face, this will be destroyed, the video will be removed. Also, if you write resistance or shaheed or any name of our commanders, it's they showed as if it's a terrorist act. They threaten you to remove your page on Facebook, Instagram, even sometimes on Twitter.
Yes.
On TikTok, which mm-hmm. is a Chinese platform, but in fact, the censorship on TikTok is much more even than Meta. So the war is brutal on us. I wrote that you know, there is everyone wants his view to truth.
Yes.
And usually, I gave an example which is about Maulana Jalaluddin Rumi. If you look to the snake, then you will see you'll consider the snake is harmful for you and it's the enemy. But if you look through the eyes of the snake, you will understand that it's defending herself and her wujuda.
Yes, their existence.
And her presence.
Yes.
But in fact, what's happening now in Gaza, what's happening now in Lebanon, the war against us, there is no gray space. It's even white or black. I believe that Netanyahu is the commander of the armies of the Westerns. So, and they are destroying our countries. They want to convince us there is no way to survive except surrendering for them or bowing for them. But in fact, this is not the truth.
Exactly.
There is no way for survive except the resistance. Even here in Iran. Some of the Iranians, I met a lot of Iranians from different. Well, some of them with the government, some of them against the government, and there is a mistaken idea that you know it's not our business, and let's make a deal with the America and everything.
Even though the Islamic Republic of Iran have been the biggest, if not the supporters,
yes.
of the axis of resistance in so many countries.
Yes, that's why we said if Iran is okay and in a good stance, then. All of us, we are okay, because Iran knows that the price of surrendering is much more than the price of resistance,
yes,
or
exactly.
facing them.
Mr. Radwan, I saw Mr. Louis, you were shaking your head in agreement, I believe, with what Mr. Radwan was saying. When it comes to, I mean, as being a historian, I'd like to direct this question to you on your comments on what Mr. Radwan said, and what do you believe is the current stance and shift in the region after that Al-Aqsa flood?
Be careful.
Go ahead, Mr. Louis. Yes.
I think I was particularly nodding when Radwan was saying about the idea that surrender does not equal safety. And I think that is a key message for, you know, as Rudwan said, some people in Iran, some people in Lebanon, you know, this idea that the war only came because of Hizb, and if we just make peace or if we just somehow remove Hizb, then everything will be okay. You know, viewing this as a historian, that is a completely ahistorical, at best, naive idea that is completely removed from the reality that the Zionist entity is a perpetually expansionist, inherently violent, inherently racist project that will not even accept capitulation. There will never be enough capitulation that the surrounding territories can offer it that will satisfy. It's insatiably territorially expansionist.
Yes.
And, you know, probably the most prominent example of, you know, a major Arab country that has made peace with Israel in Egypt. Since that peace agreement, Egypt has just become ever more impoverished, immiserated, harassed, and, you know, currently performing the shameful role of facilitating a genocide.
Well, exactly. I mean, just with that, let's just remind our audience and viewers that Egypt actually shares, I believe, 12 kilometers of border with Gaza, which includes the Rafah crossing. And as we all know, that we have 66 days, I believe, of a blockade, no food, no water. People are eating cat food to survive. They're eating rotten rice, unclean water, no fuel. Children are looking through the rubble to collect whatever wood they can to make fires. I mean, what role is Egypt playing in this part also?
I mean, Egypt is playing, obviously, it's beyond complicit. It's a participant, essentially. But I think this is not to defend Egypt's position, but I think something that needs to be understood about Egypt's reluctance to take in Gazans is their knowledge that if they were to do that in any like large scale numbers, of course resistance would continue amongst that group of refugees, which would then give Israel the justification to begin bombing and expanding into Egypt.
So they're worried for their own well-being.
And which again shows even signing a peace agreement, even capitulating, does not equal safety, stability, and success for the country, or at least the people of the country.
Yeah. Well, Mr. David, I do want to move over to you. Let's talk a bit about Israel's status after the Al-Aqsa flood. So October 7th, 2023, Mr. Miller, we had the Al-Aqsa flood actually took place. After that, we have people saying that Israel was unable to put out the operation that happened. Israel's image obviously has been changed after the Al-Aqsa flood. Now we have so many people, so many settlers, excuse me, not wanting and refusing to even join the IOF army. Where is Israel at this moment after the Al-Aqsa flood?
Thank you. I mean, let's put the case for a weakened, about to collapse Zionist entity. So yes, settlers won't join up. So yes, more than ever, people are leaving the Zionist entity, declaring they won't ever come back. Yes, their economy is a basket case. Yes, they have suffered all sorts of problems on the northern border as a result of Hezbollah, leading to thousands and thousands of settlers having to be accommodated at government expense in bed and breakfasts and hotels, where of course they are subject to rape by predatory Israelis, because of course rape is an epidemic in that society. So I could go on, but some people say as a result of that the Zionist entity is on the verge of collapse, as if to say we only have to hang on a little bit and it will collapse of its own accord. And I think there's a lot to be said for that argument, but I think in the end it's misguided. They will not collapse of their own accord. They're being kept on life support by the Americans especially, but also by Germany supplying 29% of the weaponry, and also by the UK providing much of the intelligence for targeting children in Gaza, and indeed the West Bank and Lebanon and no doubt Syria as well. So yes, of course, they're weak. Yes, of course, when the IDF comes into direct contact with Hamas or the PIJ or the PFLP or the DFLP or Hezbollah or indeed the Iraqi resistance or Ansarallah, yes, of course, they lose. They can't fight a war, fight face-to-face. Yes, of course, they were beaten by Hezbollah in the face-to-face conflict. But that's not the only part of the war. Hezbollah was seriously damaged by the pager attack and by the assassination campaign. The Israelis have air superiority in the whole region. There's no there's no challenge to that. We are not seeing Israeli jets being downed on a regular basis. We saw five or six or seven Indian jets downed just the other day. I saw someone, one of the comrades from Yemen, saying to Pakistan, "Can we have your air defence, please?" And that's what we desperately lack as a resistance axis, that kind of capacity. They win because of their bombing campaigns, because of their air superiority, because of their assassination campaign. And the resistance, so far, has no response or no adequate response to that.
Before I move back to Mr. Rodwan, we're going to talk about the resistance in a moment more in detail. I do want to go back to Mr. Louis. Mr. Louis, I do want to bring up briefly, again, one of the most developments. Since we are talking about Trump, he's going to be visiting, I believe, Saudi Arabia in the next few days, the next week. And he did say that there's going to be an announcement where he's going to be, we believe, going to try to rename the Persian Gulf or the Gulf of Persia into the Arabian Gulf. I mean, he's already done this over there with the Gulf of Mexico into now Gulf of America. And you as being, I believe you had a lot of research on this topic. So what do you think in regards to this?
I laughed when I saw that because, you know, it's just a cheap political stunt. But it's not this, the issue around Persian Gulf, Arabian Gulf is not a particularly new issue. It's been around since at least the 1950s. But having worked for many years on colonial records and archival records specifically related to the Persian Gulf, I can say with confidence that that was for hundreds of years the standardized, the common parlance and geographical terms, including in Arabic, Khalij al-Farisi, including even, for example, letters between Arab rulers. So the idea that actually that is the correct geographical term is historically and geographically silly, and it's just a reflection of, you know, the political stunt that it is. And I think it's almost not worth talking about too much.
Yes.
In a way, because it's absurd. And much like the Gulf of Mexico, Gulf of America, is that going to actually change anything?
Well, exactly.
I don't think so.
Exactly, exactly. Just him trying to push his people's buttons a little too much until perhaps one of them explode, according to what Trump tries to do these days. Mr. David Miller, as we were talking about the resistance, let's focus a bit on Gaza itself, okay, about Palestine itself. Now, we know that Gaza has been under siege for around 17 years, to be correct, but now for the past 18 months, it's been facing this genocide, this televised genocide, as people are saying. Again, let's just see that everyone sees these images. Nothing's being withheld. Things are being deleted, as our guest did mention, not only on the Gaza side, but even the IOF themselves, their soldiers. They come on social media after they've kicked people out of their houses, burned them, killed them. They come and they become arrogant and showing it off and filming themselves. They say that we have joined this army because we were told that we will be allowed to go and rape young children. They say it out loud. No one's hiding anything. I mean, how can we describe what is left of the Israeli entity itself? I mean, who are these, if we can even call them people?
Well, I mean, it's very, very hard to understand or to comprehend how deeply sick and corrupt and degenerate is Israeli society. It's not just that they are racists and dehumanize the Palestinians and commit genocide. You know, that's way worse than bad enough already. But it's that the society is so corrupt that they post these clips in glee, in the savagery with which they do it. I saw one the other day, a gender reveal party, which was a group of IF soldiers blowing up a neighborhood, and the color of the smoke in the bombs revealed the gender of the child that was about to be born to this IF soldier. I mean, there is no culture in the world which thinks that's remotely civilized or human. And that's something which is not just about Israel. It goes all the way through the Zionist movement. It's not just that there's a rape epidemic and a child abuse epidemic in Israel. It's throughout the whole Zionist movement. Many of the Zionist leaders in the UK, serial rapists of young children, It's a well-known thing, but we don't talk about it. We don't conceive of it in the same kind of way. So this is a sick society which has to be dismantled. It has to be removed from what was the phrase by Ahmadinejad, from the pages of history.
Yeah.
On the resistance, but I hear people saying, but there is no resistance now in Gaza. But if you have Telegram or X or Instagram, that you see Qassam brigades are active in all sorts of operations,
yeah,
which have significant material effects on executing, killing ILF operatives. So the resistance lives, and the resistance will live. The resistance isn't going to be beaten, and we already knew that. They can't beat the resistance. They can't beat Hezbollah. They can win a battle, but they can't win the battle. And that, of course, is their problem. They can't extinguish the flame,
yes,
of resistance. And we see that, of course, in Yemen, with the extraordinary scenes we see from Yemen of people simply being unafraid of U.S. imperialism, not just of Zionist imperialism, but of U.S. imperialism too. So that's the reality. And the question for me really is only, how quickly can they be removed? And of course, the answer to that is not quickly enough.
Exactly. Well, Mr. Louis, you did write a year ago, it was titled 4 points on solidarity after the Gaza genocide. And I'm just going to read a small part from it. You said that the gravity of the settler colonial genocide in Gaza has forced us to reckon with our role as a solidarity movement. We must support the struggle of the Palestinian people to abolish Zionism, no matter the means they choose to do it. Now, I'm saying this not because that's what Mr. David Miller said. I mean, we need them out after all the atrocities they continue to carry out. What do you believe, how important is solidarity at the moment? And not just simply condemnations. How important is action now?
Do you mean primarily solidarity in the West?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, I think if anything, you know, there's been many.
By the way, he's coming from England.
Yes.
And in England, they are looking. If he say any word, they consider it that it's supporting for Hamas or Hezbollah or,
yes,
resistance. They consider it as a crime.
Yes.
And in spite of that, he's talking.
Exactly. This is why we're all here. Exactly. Thank you, Mr. Radwan, on that point. Yes, Mr. Louis.
That is the context in which I'm speaking.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I will continue. I think there's been many painful lessons for people over the last 18 months, and I think one of them has been the inadequacy of the solidarity movement in the West, in spite of, you know, there has been, I don't want to be excessively disparaging, for example, in the UK, there has been genuine, large-scale, popular anger, outrage, disgust, very large-scale protests, but protests that the government ignores because it doesn't care, and they don't sufficiently disrupt things to force the government to take any much notice of them, besides suppressing and policing them very heavily. And I think one of the reasons from before October the 7th is an insufficient understanding of the history and of Zionism, and lots of embedded liberal Zionist myths within the very movements that think they're on the side of the Palestinians. For example, that the occupation began in 1967, that there can be some kind of better Israel than the one that currently exists, that the problem is Netanyahu, that the problem is the West Bank settlements and the settlers, quote unquote, there, rather the fact that we know that they're all settlers. And I think and of course, I will not elaborate on it too much, but of course, very problematic attitudes towards armed resistance, and many people who are only willing or capable to stand in solidarity with the Palestinians as victims, and, you know, will very happily share a photo image of a child throwing a rock, but if it's someone holding an RPG, it's a different story. And I don't think that's just because of legal consequences, it's because it predates the recent legal changes regarding Hamas and other proscripted groups. And I think that's one of the reasons, you know, like David said, none of this stuff is quick enough. None of this stuff is enough. It's very hard. You know, whatever I is able to do, it feels inadequate and it feels too slow. The end of Zionism cannot come soon enough. But one of the things that motivates me is trying to get people to understand what it is they're opposing or think they're opposing more clearly, which will hopefully lead to more effective, informed action. But I'm under no illusions about, you know, that the role of solidarity in the West is always going to be secondary to the actual resistance. It doesn't mean that it's unimportant, but it's always going to be secondary to the actual full range of resistance. I don't just mean militarily. I believe in all aspects of resistance.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step brothers not the last one
هو الذی ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودین
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth that he may make it prevail over all religions though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد موسیقی خاصی دارد روش خاصی دارد
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
منبر. A lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
The audience of IRB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ja'far Ja'far.
I begin in the name of Allah, the most kind, the most merciful. It's due to that kindness and mercy that we have these opportunities where we gather in remembrance and glorification of Him, Tabaraka wa Ta'ala. We want to continue this discussion on the subject of hypocrisy. We got to the point in this discussion where we talked about the different forms of hypocrisy. And we said that there are two main forms of hypocrisy. There is nifaq with iman, and there is nifaq in action. Today we look at the second discussion, and that is the hypocrisy of action. And so when we look at some of the characteristics of this form of hypocrisy, I want to just touch upon four that we find in our Quran and Sunnah. The first one, or the first characteristic that is there, is that of laziness and showing off when it comes to acts of worship, right? Allah Azza wa Jal in Surah An-Nisa, verse 142 and 143, He says, أَعُوذُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ اللَّعِينَ الرَّجِيمِ إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهُ وَهُوَ خَادِعُهُمْ. That the hypocrites are those who think they deceive Allah, but Allah is actually deceiving them. They deceive Him by how? By saying, look, I'm praying, God will accept. Yeah, I'm fasting, God will accept, right? And so they think that by doing these things, they are fooling God the way they can fool me, for example. To say, "Bana ito namaz parwa arosha." Yeah, he's a musalli, mashallah. You know, sometimes we're caught off guard when someone, a believer, does something and you're like, subhanallah, he prays in the first line. Yeah, he does all of these things because we're able to fool each other, right? But a hypocrite in that line, as we said yesterday and we'll talk about in the next lecture, because of their persistence in hypocrisy, they convince themselves that their hypocrisy is right, right? And when they can convince themselves that their hypocrisy is right, they end up convincing themselves that God has accepted this action. When Allah says they are deceiving, they think they are deceiving me, but in fact I'm deceiving them in the fact that these actions will have no worth whatsoever. إِنَّ الْمُنَافِقِينَ يُخَادِعُونَ اللَّهِ وَهُوَ خَادِعُهُمْ. And then He says, وَإِذَا قَامُوا إِلَى الصَّلَاةِ قَامُوا قَحْسَنْتُمْ كُسَالَ. And when they stand for prayer, they stand with full laziness. Yeah? They have no interest in this salah. They're just doing it. Chalo namaz parile. Yeah? You know, have you heard that? Like, we say that sometimes, right? Like, we have to go out. Chalo jaldi namaz parile. Let's recite namaz quickly. Like, let's get it out of the way kind of thing, right? Rather than focusing our lives in that way. Now, obviously, that statement can have multiple levels, but sometimes it's like that. Like, right? Like, where we just say, let's just quickly do it. Let's just get it out of the way to go to something bigger, go to something better, right? That's the mindset that sometimes we have. And then He says, Allah says that the only reason they are praying is yura'una nas, that they're only doing this to show off to people, to say, look, I prayed though, haven't I, right? Like, I'm doing my salah, I'm doing the things that Allah wants from me. Wala yadhkuruna Allah illa qalila, and they don't remember God except for a little. This laziness that is being referred to, right, like, means that it's not the laziness that we feel at Fajr time. You know, like to say like, let me get out of bed. No, like, Allah understands, it's hard to wake up for Fajr, yeah? And so that's not what He's talking about here, right? It's this where I just don't have any interest, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like, I don't even know how else to describe it, but that's it, like, hi, okay, let's go pray, right? And again, like, we may see this in our kids, and I don't think it refers to that either. And so there's a very specific reference here, right? Like, where maturity has kicked in, but yet the passion to worship God is not there. And I think where it's important for us is, like, we gauge our lives to see where does obedience and worship of God, how does it mix, or how does it look compared to other things that I'm passionate about, right? So, for example, do I approach food the same way I approach worship, right? Like, am I lazy to, for example, go out to a restaurant? Am I lazy, for example, to eat a meal? And do I approach it the same way and say, okay, we'll eat, right? Or do I be like, hey, where are we going? What are we doing? What do they have? Like, where does it gel? How does it meet? Right? I think that should be an indication, what's my priority? And so this laziness is really referring to, like, what is it that we prioritize? Do we prioritize God, or are there other things who are competing with God and have so far been more successful? Right? And so again, we've given this example before, is like related to the fact where reading Quran for 5 minutes is so difficult compared to scrolling on Facebook for an hour, right? Like scrolling on Facebook, easy, right? But to read Quran for 5 minutes, boy, that's a lot of work, right? And so how does that feel? Why is that laziness exist in me when my relationship to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Do we approach, you know, like so many examples, like going out with my friends, going shopping, whatever. Do I approach it the same excitement that I would for salah? Like if you look at the prophetic way, what are we told the Prophet would do when it would be time for salah? He would say to Bilal, "Arihni ya Bilal." Like, free my soul, Bilal. Go pray. Go give adhan so that you can, my soul can be free. Like, in dunya, his soul is restricted. In salah, his soul is free, right? How do we look at that, right? And so, this is something that we have to be very mindful of. And again, just if I am lazy, it doesn't mean I'm a hypocrite. I think this is something we also have to understand. It just means my priorities are incorrect. And so I have to fix it before I do become a hypocrite, right? This hypocrisy of this nature is something that I'm not sure actualizes quickly. It remains in a state of potentiality for a long time until I have decided that this is how I'm going to worship God, right? And I think this is what we have to also be mindful of. If I worship God lazily, And I do these things lazily, eventually that's the way I worship God going forward. And so you'll see, for example, my sujood, and there's actual hadith that say this, sajdas are like pecks on the ground, right? And like quick, just quick sajda, quick ruku, because I have no interest in this act of worship, right? And so I'll do these things. And this is where we find a really interesting hadith, again, from Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam. Salli ala Muhammadin wa ali Muhammad. He says, ma zada khushu' al-jasad ala ma fil qalb fahuwa indana nifakun. He says that whenever humbleness of the body supersedes that which is in the heart, in our view, that's hypocrisy, right? So my external act may look nice, but in my heart, like, I have no interest in this, right? And so that's something that we have to work on. And this is why, like, in this level of hypocrisy, I believe the issue is that my heart isn't awakened, right? My heart is not connected. Like, my mind is there because I've accepted God. My action is there because, okay, even though I'm forcing myself to pray, I'm praying, but my heart is not there. And this is why the awakening of the heart is so important and why we've spent lectures talking about it. So this is where I really think we should just analyze our lives, you know, that, like, do I pray at home with the same energy that I pray at mosque, for example, right? Like, when I'm alone, do I have that same vigor, right? Or is it a bit different at home? If I'm not coming to mosque, will I recite the same dua at home, or I only do it at mosque? That doesn't make me a hypocrite, but I think these are all indicators that to say that, hey, your heart's not connected, right? And so the more we connect our heart, the stronger our passion will be.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
كريم عظيم عليم حليم حكيم متين غفور شكور ودود قيوم رؤوف صبور مجيد وآل محمد يا مؤمنين صلوا عليه.
It's too late. If you haven't spoken up yet, it might be too late for you. This is your call to say something and not let history judge you for what you should have done.
There once was a day when we were shadows in the street, paper thin excuses crumbling at our feet. Screens glowed brightly, selling fear and doubt. The truth bled quietly, seldom spoken out. But today it's on the news again that the Zionist entity has murdered Palestinians and burned their city. Savagery is in their blood, genocide their game. The world is watching live as they enter the Hall of Shame. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history. Should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too late. Oh, it's too late. America gives the go-ahead, then it sends in bombs. Israel calls it self-defense and murders without qualms. Since when has killing children become a source of pride? Silence must be broken if you want to turn the tide. It's time we made the right choice, our lives may be on the line. It's time we raised our voice, chanting free, free Palestine. The police can do what they want to do, detain one or two. The thousands of millions are coming through, a move they cannot undo. Don't they see nations waking up? Don't they see people rising up? Don't they see that we won't bow? It's too late to stop us now. It's too late to stop us now. It's too late. Can't you see the land is breaking? It's too late. Can't you see the children dying? It's too late. Let's not be judged by history for what we should have done to save humanity. It's too late. Oh, it's too
You are listening to Iran Radio, and we are so glad to have you on this part of our schedule. And here are some interesting facts about Islam. Let's listen. Islam is the world's second largest religion, and it is a monotheistic faith with about 1.8 billion followers worldwide, originating in Mecca during the life of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Islam means submission to the will of Allah, and its followers are called Muslims. Muslims believe in one God, Allah, who is the creator of all things and has no partners or equals. The Quran is the holy book of Islam, believed to be the literal word of Allah revealed to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of Allah upon him and his progeny. Muslims adhere to the five pillars of Islam: Shahada, or declaration of faith; Salah, or prayer; Zakat, or charity; Saum, or fasting during Ramadan; and Hajj, or pilgrimage to Mecca. The Islamic year is 11 days shorter than the year used in the Western world. This is because the Western year is based on the orbit of the Earth around the Sun instead of on the faces of the Moon. And we'll listen to continuation of Iran Radio. First, we bring you a new edition of Round the World with reporters. Then Radio Productions returns with more engaging content. Then stay with us for the Keys of Life. In this enriching segment, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musavi presents significance into the Islamic way of living, inspired by Mafatihul Hayat, the profound work of Ayatollah Javadi Amali. Each episode offers practical guidance rooted in spirituality and ethics, helping us live with purpose, compassion, and clarity. Coming up, it's time for Round the World with Reporters. Don't go anywhere.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the World with Reporters.
Joint U.S.-South Korea military drills have dramatically increased in frequency in the last few years, especially near the DMZ. Residents want the disturbing and provocative drills to end, and they have some support at South Korea's National Assembly, where lawmakers push back on U.S. demands.
They're simultaneously pressuring South Korea to increase training and even send strategic weapons to South Korea. Therefore, peace on the Korean Peninsula can only be achieved by boldly rejecting these demands from the U.S. military and immediately halting military exercises.
Anti-U.S. sentiment has been on the rise in South Korea, also due to U.S. President Donald Trump's tariff extortion.
FTAs and free trade have long since disappeared, and the UN and WTO systems have also disappeared. What the U.S. is doing now is literally colonialism. We cannot give in here.
It was back in September of 2018 that South Korean President Moon Jae-in and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un signed an agreement on measures to reduce tensions, particularly in the border areas. With a liberal leader back in office in Seoul, peace advocates want the 2018 deal renewed and drills to end.
Continuing these joint exercises will only serve to further fuel the fire and contribute nothing to peace. The South Korea-U.S. joint military exercises must be suspended, and the hostile and Cold War attitudes must be replaced with an attitude of dialogue and peaceful coexistence.
Calls for a stronger stance in relations with the U.S. president have been widely expressed in Seoul, underscoring public sentiment that the government should adopt a more assertive approach in its diplomatic dealings.
South Korean President Lee Jae-myung is under public pressure here to take a firm stand on issues with the United States, as just days ago some 300 high-tech workers were expelled from the U.S. President Donald Trump also demands $350 billion of investment from South Korea, and for Seoul to drastically increase its military spending.
On Monday, the U.S., South Korea, and Japan began another round of military drills in waters off of Jeju Island. Frank Smith, Seoul.
The relationship between the federal government in Baghdad and the Kurdistan regional government continues to swing between tension and compromise amid financial and economic complications that have yet to find a solution. But negotiation is still ongoing between the two sides.
Negotiations swing back and forth, sometimes with pressure on Erbil, other times on Baghdad. But the ultimate outcome depends on whether the region delivers its oil to the federal government in return for its full share of 12.67%. So far, however, the Kurdish stance remains unclear, both in interpreting the percentage and in its unilateral handling of oil sales.
The issue of oil export from the region through the Jihan port, which was supposed to resume at the capacity of around 400,000 barrels per day, remains on hold. Politically, there appear to be a temporary arrangement to keep matters moving until the upcoming elections, as the Kurdistan Democratic Party seeks to secure concessions through its role in parliamentary alliance and the formation of the new government.
There may be certain compromises by the government to keep matters moving forward, especially as we approach elections and the subsequent formation of a new government. The Kurdistan Regional Government, particularly the Kurdistan Democratic Party, appears to be seeking to secure certain privileges during this phase, both before and after the elections, by playing a role in the largest parliamentary coalition that nominates the prime minister and forms the new government.
With no decisive results from ongoing committees, the unresolved files are likely to face further delays until border political deal is reached. The relationship between Baghdad and Erbil has a long swung between tension and cooperation over oil budget and authority, making it one of the main challenges in Iraqi politics. The ongoing dialogue seen as strategic opportunity to preserve national balance. Nawar Faik, Baghdad.
The Iranian delegation attending the IAEA General Conference has held an event shedding light on the country's resolution that reaffirms the prohibition of attacks on nuclear facilities. The Venezuelan envoy to Vienna chaired the event.
Welcome to this side event organized by the Islamic Republic of Iran to address the issue of the attacks against nuclear sites and facilities, a serious threat to international peace and security, and to address its implications for the non-proliferation regime.
The event was addressed by some of the IAEA states which co-sponsored it, such as China, Pakistan, and South Africa.
In all the member states should side with one side, which is preserving the NPT regime and IAEA safeguard regime. So let's work together to try to stand on the right side of history.
Given the grave consequences for population and the environment of any attacks on nuclear facilities, in our view, the space for attacks on nuclear facilities is non-existent.
Meanwhile, Russia called on Britain, France, and Germany, collectively known as the E3, to stop the snapback mechanism. The E3 triggered the mechanism in early August that would restore UN Security Council sanctions against Iran. The final deadline for a decision is September 27. The Russian envoy also criticized the U.S. and Israel for attacking Iranian nuclear sites in June.
What Israel and the United States did was the biggest blow to the IAEA safeguards system. The E3 should also stop the implementation of snapback mechanism in New York. Triggering snapback was illegal, politically irrelevant, and counterproductive.
Iran's permanent representative to the IAEA reiterated the illegality of the U.S. and Israeli attacks on the Iranian nuclear sites.
The attack on the Iran's nuclear facilities under the IAEA safeguard is unprecedented in the history of the agency. This is the first time, while the facility being under full scope safeguards of the agency and inspected on a daily basis, we had inspectors in all facilities almost all the time, and facilities been attacked by one non-party to the NPT and the other one, unfortunately, the depository of the NPT, which is the United States.
The U.S. delegation is meanwhile putting pressure on IAEA member states, particularly in the Western and North African regions, not to support the Iranian resolution.
In 1977, Amendments 1 and 2 of the Geneva Convention prohibited attacks and threats on nuclear facilities. But the U.S. are threatening to cut bilateral ties with countries if the Iranian resolution passes. A reckless behavior putting global security at risk. Dieter Reinisch,